We are turning again to the prophecy of Habakkuk. We continue our present studies in this prophecy of Habakkuk, the fifth last book of the Old Testament, between the prophecies of Nahum and Zephaniah. You will find the book of Habakkuk. We have been looking at this prophecy now for a few weeks, and we're in chapter 2. We have seen that the problem with which this prophecy deals is the problem of what is God doing in the world? Does he care? Does he know what is happening in the world? And that's how the prophecy begins. The prophet Habakkuk is concerned that within the Church of God in the Old Testament, there was violence, the law was held in contempt, there was no righteousness in judgment, and God seemed to be either not interested or simply not there, and he certainly didn't seem to be doing anything about it, and the prophet is crying out, how long is God going to allow this to happen? Because after all, he does believe that God had said many times before his times that he would deal with sin and that he was a righteous judge. And in Habakkuk's day, sin seemed to be just rampant and nothing seemed to be happening to stop it or deal with it in any way. And so the prophet asks the question and the Lord answers the question. And he tells him that Habakkuk wouldn't even understand what he's doing, even if he were told. He says, you wouldn't even understand what it is I'm doing about sin. But he does tell him that in the immediate, he is raising up the Chaldeans, the bitter and hasty nation, and they're going to come. And they're going to be God's instruments to chastise his people. And his people are going to learn once and for all that they cannot sin against God with impunity. They are going to go into exile. And this was, of course, the great Babylonian exile of which the Old Testament says so much and which subsequent historians of the Old Testament have acknowledged was the greatest crisis that Israel ever faced in its history in the Old Testament. Nothing was quite like it. Nothing was so severe. And Israel just about died out. It seemed on the face of it to be the end of the people of God, but we know it wasn't because God had said that he would bring them back again. And he did. And then when the Lord answers Habakkuk and says to him that he is dealing with Israel through the Babylonians or the Chaldeans, that raises another perplexing question from the prophet. Well, how can God do this? How can he ally himself and seemingly approve of what these Chaldeans are doing? And so this is even a more perplexing question. And in chapter 2, the prophet begins by saying, I'm going to wait until God answers me. And the Lord does answer him from verse 2 onwards, and he tells Habakkuk to write down the prophecy. He is writing down the reply that God gives to him. And it's to be written so clearly as to be unmistakably plain, and it is to be permanent, because God is saying to Habakkuk and to us, the way that I deal in the world is always the same, and let's make no mistake about it. And so what the rest of this chapter is all about is that God is insisting to the prophet that he knows all about sin. He goes into details concerning the kinds of sins with which Babylon was associated particularly, and indeed with which we know from other portions of the Old Testament the people of Israel were also associated. And so the Lord is reminding Habakkuk and us, he's saying, I'm not ignorant of what goes on in the church and in the world. I know perfectly well what's going on. And even if you don't see what I'm doing, I know what I'm doing, and I'll do it my way and in my time. But in these verses in chapter 2, the prophet is being told of certain sins. The Lord mentions five categories of sins from verse number 5 onwards. And we have looked at three of these so far. Arrogance, the greed, the violence, the cruelty to those people who were defeated. And the seeking of personal prosperity at the cost of others, at the expense of others. And here we have abiding principles, Because we know that in other places of the Old Testament, God's people were accused of the very same kinds of things. And God said that he was taking note and that he would deal with them because they were prospering themselves at the expense of the poor. Indeed, at one stage, they were even selling their fellow Israelites into slavery and selling their daughters for gain and all that kind of thing. And the Lord is saying, I know all about what's going on in churches and I'll deal with it. So we've looked at the first three of these sins, verses 5 or 6 to verse 14. And we were looking at verse 14 in particular last Sunday evening. Well, we go on from there this evening to verses 15 to 20 to the end of the chapter. And there are two more categories of sins mentioned here. There is first of all drunkenness, and then there is also idolatry. Woe unto him that giveth his neighbor drink, that puttest thy bottle to him, and makest him drunken also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness. Thou art filled with shame for glory. Drink thou also, and let thy foreskin be uncovered. The cup of the Lord's right hand shall be turned unto thee, and shameful spewing shall be on thy glory. For the violence of Lebanon shall cover thee, and the spoil of beasts which made them afraid, because of men's blood, and for the violence of the land of the city, and of all that dwell therein. What does it profit the graven image that the maker thereof hath graven it, the molten image, and a teacher of lies, that the maker of his work trusteth therein to make dumb idols? Woe unto him that says to the wood, awake, to the dumb stone, arise, it shall teach. Behold, it is laid over with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all in the midst of it. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. And verse number 20 is the last statement that God makes in the prophecy of Habakkuk. More than half of the prophecy of Habakkuk is taken up with the Lord speaking directly. But his final comment is in verse number 20, and God willing, we'll come back and look at this verse 20 next time. But this evening we come to these verses 15 to 20, where the Lord is speaking concerning the final two sins that he mentions. And in verses 15 to 17, we have drunkenness, and in verse 18 to 20, we have his condemnation of idolatry. Now we might think, well, all of this is hardly relevant for a Sunday evening service. After all, people come to church and they want a spiritual pick-me-up. And I have been accused on quite a number of occasions over the years of being a depressing kind of a preacher. Well, I don't know if I'm depressing or not. Maybe I am. But if you read through the prophecy of Isaiah, you will find a twofold response. At least I have a twofold response to it. On the one hand, I find myself reading Isaiah. It's pretty heavy going, actually, and at times I feel depressed. But then Isaiah also has those glorious moments. And because of those more glorious evangelical moments, he is called the evangelical prophet. And so in the scriptures, we find that the prophets, they spoke about solemn things, and they didn't mince over it. They went through the teaching of God's word, and if God is pleased to give to us descriptions of sin that are quite discouraging and disheartening to our natural mind, then we have to pay attention to what God the Lord is speaking. One of the advantages of going through portions of the Bible is you take what comes. If I were simply picking texts out of the Bible, I'd be picking all the good ones, and I would never dream of coming to a passage like this, in case it would, as it were, depress the people and also deplete the congregation. But we take God's word as we find it. Now, in these verses 15 to 17, drunkenness is mentioned. Now, this is part of a prophecy that is to be written plain and written permanent. And that means that God didn't intend this portion simply for the time in which the prophet was living. It was something that is to be a permanent record. And we know from chapter 2 at verse number 4, for example, that the New Testament writers regarded this passage of Habakkuk as a permanent record relevant for New Testament times. Verse 4, the just shall live by faith. That is taken up as in our New Testament in three places, as we've seen. And it is applied to New Testament times just as much as it was relevant for the people in Habakkuk's day. So the whole of this prophecy is not just something that is of passing interest and of historical value. It is not just ancient scribblings or historical documents. It is the living Word of God. And when the Lord here says, "Woe unto him that giveth his neighbor drink," and then goes on to describe the shameful consequences of drunkenness, he is speaking to our generation. And we have only to look at history. We've only to look around us. We've only to read tomorrow's newspapers. And we will find that the consequences of drunkenness today will be written large in our headlines tomorrow. And this is the way it always is. And every day is just the same. History just repeats itself. But the Bible is very clear on one thing, and that is that drunkenness is a sin. And I'm emphasizing that because we're living in a day where everything is excused and everything is explained. And we are told today that drunkenness is not a sin, it is a sickness that's to be pitied. And the man who is a drunkard is not really a drunkard, he's called an alcoholic. And alcoholics will tell you that the alcohol is in the bottle and the ism is in them. And they will say that they have a predisposition to alcoholism or alcohol dependency. Now, I do not know if they have a dependency or not. Maybe they do have a tendency to that. But if it is, then it is a weakness that must be resisted. You remember how Cain was reminded way back in the early chapters of Genesis that sin lay at his door. And he had to resist it. We all have areas of weakness. There are some sins that I'm prone to. There are some sins, and quite frankly, they don't bother me in the least. And I'm not interested in them. Other sins, I find I've got to guard myself against them. Because we all have areas of weakness. And we've got to know what that area of weakness is. And we have to be on our special guard against that area of weakness. And so when the Scripture speaks of drunkenness, as it does in the Psalms, in many of the prophets, one has only to read prophets. And you find over and over again that this sin of drunkenness is absolutely condemned. And the prophet here is speaking in terms of the drunkenness of the Chaldeans and the drunkenness that was found at this particular time, even within the professing people of God. They were drunkards as much as these Chaldeans were drunkards. If you know anything about history, and I know that some of you do, you will know that it's as far as we can tell, there never has been a society that hasn't made alcohol. And they have made it out of roots, they've made it out of potatoes and out of all kinds of vegetables. They've made it out anything they can find that will ferment. They have made liquor out of it. And they have indulged in that liquor. And the Chaldeans, they were guilty of this. Every single ungodly nation, every single ungodly society has been characterized to a greater or lesser extent by drunkenness. And ancient archaeological finds have indeed demonstrated that people valued and stored up potential alcoholic material for making whatever it was that they were drinking. Now here we are given a picture of this alcoholic binge that is being described here. Now it's not clear. The scholars differ as to exactly what is being referred to here, because there is a description in these verses of drunken behavior which seems to be quite specific and seems to be referring to something actually before the prophet's mind, so to speak. God is going into details, and that means that the prophet could actually see something taking place in terms of drunkenness that has actually been described in these verses before us. Who giveth his neighbor drink. And here is the picture of someone who is encouraging his neighbor to take drink. And tragically, we all know that sometimes it is true that the first drink is often given in the family. We know of sons, I know of men who are now men, but who were given their first taste of alcoholic drink by their own fathers. Where did they learn to drink? When did they first of all develop a taste for liquor? And they developed a taste for liquor in their home. Their father introduced them to drink. Now, we're not saying that the fathers determined that their children would be drunkards. They never intended that, probably. But nonetheless, they were the ones who guided them and introduced them into that road that led to drunken misbehavior. And so here is a picture: woe unto him that giveth his neighbor drink. Do not ever encourage anybody to drink. That's what the prophet is saying here. We cannot control people's attitudes or people's activities. But we do not need to be encouraging them in drink. We do not need to be setting before them an example and encouraging them to be a man, so to speak, and to take their first drink. And this is what is being condemned. Now, it's not clear exactly what the prophet has in mind. Who is it that is encouraging whoever to drink? It may well be that here are these victorious Chaldean soldiers, and they are reveling in their victory. And whether it be the victory in war or the victory in the playing fields, we all know that after the victory, the winning side goes and has a good old booze up in order to celebrate their victory. And they invite other people to join in their drunken festivities, and they encourage them to drink. And it may well be that what the prophet has in mind is, in fact, the Chaldeans. They have all these Hebrew captives, you see. And these drunken Chaldean soldiers are now encouraging these Hebrew captives to share in their drunken festivities and revelries. That may well be the picture. We do not know. Or it may be another picture that the prophet has in mind. And it may well be the picture of religious celebrations, where these Chaldean soldiers, in their idolatrous worship, they were indulging in drunken orgies. And it may well be that they were encouraging one another to worship the false gods to whom they attributed the victory over the Hebrew nation. That may well be. We do not know for sure. That puttest the bottle to him, and makest him drunken also, that thou mayest look on their nakedness. But the point surely that the prophet is emphasizing, whether it be simply drunken military victory that is being celebrated, whether it be some religious festival in which there is drunken immorality being indulged in, whatever it be, the point is there is a moral content. You see, we're living in a world increasingly where the drunkard is smiled at. You see a man in the street and people smile. It's increasingly tolerated. Alcohol is advertised. Indeed, in some societies, it is almost indispensable. It is relatively cheap to buy. It is the socially acceptable drink just about wherever you go in the world. The polite societies, the religious societies, they do not frown on it as they do at other drugs, for example. And it could well be that we are missing the point of what the Bible is actually saying about drunkenness. Because ultimately, the problem with drunkenness is the loss of control, the loss of human reason. Quite apart from the other health factors, gastritis and liver problems and, I understand, stomach cancers and brain damage and who knows all what other physical aspects of excessive drinking. There is a moral content, and there are tremendous moral consequences that follow from drunken behavior or misbehavior. And look how the prophet here describes it, that thou mayest look on their nakedness. There seems to be a common mode of behavior among people that get drunk, and that is they begin to take off their clothes. They begin to expose themselves in their nakedness. Thou art filled with shame for glory. Drink thou also. Let thy foreskin be uncovered. It may well be that what the prophet has in mind here is these drunken soldiers of the Chaldean army raping the women. That may well be. Or it may be simply that orgiastic display of their nakedness and their shame. And the picture here is of spewing and of vomiting one upon the other and upon their clothes. The whole picture is of shameful degradation. Now we may say, well, that belongs to primitive societies. No, it doesn't. You go around the streets of Sydney tonight and you will find vomit lying on the pavements. I passed vomit down there in Pitt Street as I was coming to church on one of the corners. And you will find that there are many women tonight and they are going to be sexually molested because they have been rendered drunk by those who have encouraged them to drink. And they have been uncovered naked, and they have been subjected to who knows what kind of shameful treatment. That our jails are filled with men and with women too, who, if it were not for drink, would never have ended up there. The moments, careless drinking, drunk driving. We could multiply examples. I was drunk, Your Honor. I'm excused because I was drunk. Rapists often say that. and people who commit serious crimes when they're drunk. Many of the crimes that you and I read about, they're committed under the influence of alcohol. And it is this moral content. Alcoholism is not some kind of medical condition. Medical help seems to be very futile in many cases with alcoholism. It seems to be one of the most difficult habits to give up. I remember a medical man in St. Vincent's Hospital, one of the experts in drug addiction there. I remember hearing him on the radio one time. He was being interviewed. And he said that in his experience, he said alcohol was the most addictive of all the drugs. You can get people off tobacco, he said. You can get people off the hard drugs. But there seems to be something peculiarly addictive about alcohol. People like it. It is so natural. It is so acceptable. There's no social stigma attached to it. And men and women will boast of how drunk they were the night before, and what a great time they had, and what they did in their drunken debauchery. But here the Lord is condemning it all, because there is the loss of reason. You and I have minds made to think godly thoughts. We have to be very careful that we guard our mind, that we keep our reason, and the moment that we begin to indulge in this drunken misbehavior, we are deliberately abandoning self-control. We are losing our moral sense. People think that drunkenness or that alcohol is a kind of stimulant. In a sense, it is a stimulant. But basically, it's not a stimulant. In the end, it is actually a depressive. And it depresses those higher centers, apparently, in our consciousness, where we have the moral sense and that judgmental sense. And we begin to do things basically and base and carnal that we would never dream of doing unless our senses were degraded and in some way suppressed by the misuse of alcohol. And it is very addictive, and it is so sociably acceptable. Everybody does it. And the younger you start, the more likely you're going to become involved and addicted to it. And the statistics are very clear. I know of some men, if I may introduce some personally. I know some men who grew up with me and with whom I was at school. And these men are dead. And I know of at least two of these men who died in the gutter practically as drunkards, confirmed drunkards. And I know these. I knew these boys when they were boys. And they both started off early, about 16 years of age. They never intended to end up drunkards and derelicts, but that's how they ended up. So we know these things, you see, from personal experience. And the great issue that God is taking with the people who indulge in such misbehavior is not so much the physical. Of course the physical, the spewing and the uncovering of the foreskin and all these disgraceful displays of misbehavior. Of course these are bad enough, but it is the moral content. It is the sheer ungodliness of it all. It is the sheer shamefulness of men and women who are made to glorify God and to enjoy God with their God-given bodies. The belly is for meat and our bodies are for God's glory, not for this kind of basic animal disgraceful behavior. And notice how the Lord speaks of how he's going to judge them. Shameful spewing shall be on thy glory. Here is a picture of disgraceful, degraded lives. For the violence of Lebanon shall cover thee. They are going to be dealt with as they have dealt with others. And God is going to pour out upon them his cup of wrath. The Bible speaks of God having a wine glass in his hand, so to speak. Psalm 75. And it is red, it is overflowing with the foaming wine. And those who wish to involve themselves and deliberately involve themselves in this kind of graceful, disgraceful misbehavior, the Lord said they are going to drink one day. They are going to drink from his hand. He will give them the cup to drink. And it will be a cup of wine that is the fullness of his wrath. And they will know shame. And they will have chosen this destiny for themselves. They will have made up their minds. Now, I'm not going to start preaching over much about temperance and about that kind of thing. You know my position. We're talking about it casually in the morning. But in this drink-sodden society of Australia, I think the wisdom for Christians is to leave it alone, quite frankly. Because after all, we are to have no appearance of evil.
And we have to be very careful as Christians that by our use of alcohol, we may well be putting a cup into someone's hand. Maybe we can cope with it, but maybe they cannot cope with it. Because ultimately, if they end up in this degraded condition that is being spoken of here, we will have had a hand in it. And we will have had a hand in it deliberately by our choice. And we have to be very conscious, not only of what we do, but of the consequences of what we do. We are to think ahead, so to speak. When the Lord makes plans, that's interesting in the Bible. When the Lord makes plans and gives us prophecies, he tells us not only what he's going to do, but he tells us the consequences that are going to follow from what he does. And when he implements the great scheme of salvation, he tells us there are going to be blessed consequences, salvation and heaven, deliverance from death. He tells us what will happen when he does things. We've got to think in those terms also. What will happen if we simply go with the flow? We may be encouraging people who have a particular weakness in this area, and we will have given to them an encouragement to indulge it. There's a lot more we could say because the Bible says a great deal more about it. You read the closing verses in the 23rd chapter of the book of Proverbs, and you will find there a description of the drunkard. That text has been called the drunkard's charter. That closing passage in Proverbs chapter 23. And there you have the description of a man who has lost all semblance of restraint and all sensitivity. A man who could sleep in the most unpleasant places. And he wakes up in the morning with his sore head. And he says, I will have it yet again. I will go to it yet again. The drunkard is condemned by God because his behavior is not a sickness that is to be pitied and treated. His problem is a sin that is to be repented. And that's why we were reading in Galatians chapter 5, because amongst the sins of the flesh, the works of the flesh, is included drunkenness. It is a work of the flesh, and in that sense it is a diametrical opposite of the work of the Spirit. And this is how we're to understand it. And here is the Lord's condemnation, unmitigated, unqualified, clearly, as clear as clear can be. And so the Lord has warned us. And I find it often so embarrassing and so shameful and so extraordinary that often the natural man, he gets buried. He dies as we all die in the end. And then all his friends, they have a good old party. And they're drinking to his memory, and he's up there, and they're saying, we know you're with us, we know. That is the height of foolishness, the height of absolute unreality. If these people could only grasp the awful destiny that awaits the drunkard, there is no salvation for the drunkard. Only if he repents and gives it up is the kingdom of God available to him, according to the Bible. Now, this applies to the Chaldeans. It applies to the Babylonians, it applies to the Assyrians. As far as we know, there never has been a victorious army that has not indulged itself in this particular way. Bring on the dancing girls, bring on the wine, the women, and the song. We've won the great victory. The Romans did it. The Greeks did it. The Greeks were notorious for drunkenness. The Chaldeans, the Assyrians, the Egyptians, down through the ages, the British army. One German commentator said of the British Army during the First World War, he said that he was astonished at how much whiskey the British Army carried into battle with it. He was astonished at the amount of liquor that they carried. And we could speak about this all night and all day tomorrow and all next week, I'm sure. But the point is clear, woe unto him that giveth his neighbor drink, and uncovers his nakedness, and spews all over other people, and shows his foreskin, and indulges in all this indecent misbehavior. You see, the Bible speaks plain language. I know there are some preachers say, well, this is not fit for the pulpit. Well, if it's not fit for the pulpit, it's not fit for the Bible. And if it's fit for the Bible, it's fit for the pulpit. And if it's fit for the pulpit, it's fit for any time, a Sunday evening service in the pulpit. But we turn now to the next verses, 18 to 20, where we have here idolatry. And here again, there is the woe unto him that says to the wood, awake, to the dumb stone, arise, and so on. What essentially is idolatry? I think that perhaps we tend to think of idolatry in terms of the making of little idols, or big idols for that matter. And of course that is idolatry. But that's not the real problem with idolatry. That's only the consequences of idolatry. It's like the sin of Adam and Eve. The sin of Adam and Eve was not eating the forbidden fruit as such. That was just the outward expression of it. They had already defected. They were already determined to do something in terms of disobedience before they ate the fruit. The actual doing of the deed is only the consequence of the inward desire to do it. And so the question of idolatry is not the making of idols. It is the desire to make idols. It is the determination to make idols. The thought comes before the deed always in this world. And so the real problem of idolatry is not in the idol. The Bible tells us the idol itself is nothing. It's only an artifact made by men's hands. The problem is in the heart of man, not in the hands of man. And Tozer is quite right when in his book, The Knowledge of the Holy, he points out what is the big problem of the world. And the problem of the world is that the world thinks wrongly concerning God. Tozer tells us in that book, you determine, if you can, what a man thinks of God, and you will determine his destiny. Because what we think about God is the most important thing about us. You and I will not have any greater thoughts than our thoughts of God. And our lives will never rise higher than our thoughts of God. And so what is the problem with the idolater? It's not that he doesn't believe in God. He may well believe in God. It may be that he believes in the living and the true God of the Bible, for all we know. But he has wrong thoughts of God. He's thinking about God in the wrong way. He is thinking unworthy thoughts of God. He thinks that God can be represented in the works of his hands. Those of you, I'm sure, some of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the writings of Gresham Machen. And you will know that he has a marvelous little book entitled God Transcendent, published by the Banner of Truth, a paperback. And in that book, he has a number of chapters dealing with, I think they're sermons put into print, and in one of these sermons, he is dealing with Isaiah's scorn of idolatry. And he's using the text, Isaiah chapter 44, you remember, where the prophet there is scoffing and mocking the man who cuts down a tree and shapes it and burns part of it in the fire and makes his meal of it, and then he makes a little object and he says to this idol, you are my God. And Isaiah has no sympathy with the delusions of that man. He's not saying that here is a man who is to be pitied. He says here is a man who is to be mocked and he is to be condemned. Because he has a thought of God that is wrong and he pursues it. He clings to his false view of God. And he says to this, the product of his hands, you are my God. And he bows down before it. Such a foolish, ultimately degrading, foolish act for a man who is desiring to worship God. Have we ever wondered why? Away back in the time of the Exodus, in Exodus chapter 20, the first commandments in the Ten Commandments have to do with our views of God. And if we get these views wrong, then everything else in our life is going to be wrong. What is the problem with men? It is that they don't know God. They may believe that there is someone or something up there or somewhere, but they do not have a proper view of God. And the Lord knew how prone we are to think wrong thoughts of him. Not simply to invent gods for ourselves, but to have wrong views of the living God that leads us to make little images that we think may be like him. And the commandments, you remember those opening commandments, they deal with no other gods and you will not make any graven images of any kind. Why not any kind? Because God isn't like any kind. He's not like anything in the earth, or under the earth, or above the earth. He's not like any four-footed beast, or fish, or bird. God is not like anything in the created order. He belongs to a different order of existence. You remember how... Have you ever wondered how Ezekiel, in the first chapter of his prophecy, you remember he tells us there, I saw visions of God, he says. And the first chapter of Ezekiel's prophecy is taken up with a description. And what's it a description of? Well, Ezekiel says it's a description of God. But when you look at the description, it's a description of a storm. It's a description of clouds. It's a description of wheels within wheels. It's a description of spokes. It's a description of some strange creatures going this way and then going that way. In other words, it's a description that's very difficult to visualize what, in fact, Ezekiel is describing. Some say that he was describing a spaceship. And some say that he was describing other idols that were familiar, those idols with which he was just inventing. Some say he was hallucinating, having some kind of mental turn. And that the things that Ezekiel was seeing are very typical of what epileptics see, for example. That's what some are saying. But what is Ezekiel actually saying to us? He's not saying to us that he saw the image of God, because there is no such thing as the image of God. He is saying to us that he saw God in action. God is like a storm. He's always active. He goes this way, he goes that way. Wheels within wheels. There's a deep mystery and a deep providence. God does things and makes himself known in things we simply cannot describe or understand it. That is what Ezekiel is driving at. He says he is indescribable, but I'll try to give you an inkling. He was like unto, but not literally like unto, but this is the kind of thing that he does. He comes in clouds, he comes and he goes here and he goes there, and he's always active. It's the picture of immense vitality and activity. And you're just never sure at times where you are with him. And this is why idolatry is such an offense to God. It is a violation of his essential being. It is men replacing the living God who is worshipped only according to his word, without imaginations. The less imagination you and I have in worship, you know, the better. That is why there was no image in the Holy of Holies. And I've told you the story before of how the Roman general Pompey, when he went in to invade it, when the Romans came into Judea in the first century BC, and he thought, well, now we'll go into the temple and find out once and for all what lies behind this great curtain. He went in, there was nothing there. It was just a square cube of a box. There was nothing there whatsoever. And he thought that these Jews were idolaters, or indeed he thought that they were atheists because they had no gods. There was nothing there. In the old time, before Solomon's temple was destroyed, at the time of the Babylonian captivity, all there was the law of the covenant, two angels guarding the holy things of God. But there was no image of God. There was nothing representative of any creature in heaven or earth or anywhere else. Now, why is it that we are inveterate idolaters? Because we have a desire to worship something. And if we do not wish to worship the living and the true God according to his self-disclosure, then we will make up for ourselves his image and we will worship. But we will worship. There is something within us that desires to worship and demands worship. And that is why Paul the Apostle speaks of idolatry in Romans chapter 1 from verse 18. And he speaks of it in terms of the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all the unrighteousness and the ungodliness of men who hold down the truth in unrighteousness. God has revealed himself. He has made himself known in creation. He has made himself known in revelation. He has made himself known in the community of his redeemed people. But the world has never wanted that revelation. The world has always found that unacceptable. And we will worship our way. And that's why in Psalm 115, The psalmist makes a very, very personal and poignant point when he makes the comment that the nations who make these gods, they are like the gods that they make. Cruel nations make ugly gods. They make cruel gods. It's not that the gods make the people cruel. The Maya and the Incas, for example, they were a cruel people, and their gods were horrible to look at, obscene figures. And why did they make them those grotesque obscenities? Because they were cruel. They were a cruel people. That's why. Why was it that the Greeks had more refined images of what the deity looked like? Because they were more humanistic. They were interested in the human body. And they thought, therefore, that the gods would be more like men. And so they made them more like human beings. You see, the makers of the idols, they make them in their own image. And if you think that if you belong to a refined, sophisticated, rather sophisticated society such as the Greeks were, then your gods will be rather refined and rather beautiful. And if you belong to a grotesque, basically cruel community, then your gods will be likewise. We make our gods, you see, in our own image. Now, all of this, you might say, well, what relevance of all of this? What's this to do with us? We're living in this secular world, 2009. This is Australia. What are you preaching about all this for? Because Australia is full of gods, that's why. The idols of silver and gold, the things that men value, that is their god. I'm not saying that they worship their football teams as such. But you speak to a devotee of some football team, and he will tell you, footy is my religion. I've heard a man say in Glasgow, holding up a £5 note, this is my god. Some people say, well, I just worship my wife. I worship my children, these darling little angels. I worship my children. Well, woe upon the man who worships his children, or worships his footy team, or puts anything, any piece of silver or gold, or any personality, or any religion for that matter, before the living and the true God of the Bible. Woe unto him that saith to the wood, awake. The astrologers, they write their nonsense in the papers, and people going to work, they open their newspapers at the astrology section. They look up their star sign, their place in the cosmos. What constellation do they belong to? And then they look it up for the day and they say, I'm going to have good fortune today. Where did people get this insane idea? Where? Because somewhere deep in our psyche, there is a desire for the mysterious and the unknown. We're simply not satisfied with bare scientific facts, you see. So we'll invent religions of all different kinds. And these religions become our gods. And they're always expensive. They're always demanding. These false gods, they never do anything for you. They always demand that you do for them. But the God of the Bible is the God who does things for his people. And as we're going to see next Sunday evening, the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. I suppose it is true that we are all basically idolaters. We all have a tendency to put something or someone before God. I say to people at weddings, for example, if I'm counseling the young couple, for example, I say to them, to the young man, don't put her before God. Put God first and put whatever her name is. Put her second. And then I say to the young lady or whatever, I say, now don't put so-and-so first. Don't put him first in your life. Put God first in your life and put him second. Let him be the first man in your life. Let her be the first woman, but let her not be the first personality. Don't put ourselves first. Put God first. And this is the way that the Bible would always have it. This is what Jesus tells us to do. Amidst all the cares of the gold and the silver of this world, do not be anxious about the things of this world. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all other things will be added unto you. Idolatry, it is mocked in the Bible. Daniel chapter 3, you remember the great golden pinnacle where all the people were to bow down, and it was covered with pure gold. Men's idolatrous schemes are always, always expensive, as we know from the present government in Australia, always expensive with other people's money. It's always expensive, the schemes and the dreams of those in power. And it's always the same. But in the scriptures, we have a God who humbles himself and who comes down to our level and who enters into our experiences and who comes not to make demands of us, but to make demands upon himself, who humbles himself to behold the things upon the earth. And who humbles himself even to the death of the cross, that he might bring us to our senses and bring us to salvation and bring us at the last to glory and deliver us from this foolishness of idolatry. We all worship something. The man who doesn't worship something has never existed. And for all the protestations of the secularists, they have worship too. What do they worship? Human reason is the worship. That's the present myth of our generation. Human reason is the new idol, and everything must conform to human reason. This is how it always is. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence. We are here reminded in this closing statement of the Lord's great prophecy to Habakkuk, that the Lord is, that he is in heaven, that he sees, he knows, he controls. And we're going to see next time when we look at this. He is always separate. He is always sovereign. And the earth must learn to stop talking and keep silence and listen to what he has to say. Because it is only as we keep silence before him that we will allow him to speak to us. And in listening to his voice, we will come to the knowledge of him. And we will come to our senses and to salvation. These are the issues, you see. So this is not just ancient scribblings relevant for some time in the 6th century BC. These are statements that are relevant for our drunken, idolatrous Australia today and for the tendency of the church to indulge and to smile and to condone and indeed to, in a measure, approve even. The prophet was given the answer to his question. What is God doing? God punishes sin always, everywhere, in his own way, in his own time, but he also saves the sinner who trusts in him. The just shall live by faith. That's the message of Habakkuk. And we'll look further at this, God willing, next Sunday evening. May God bless his word.